From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. As New Hampshire voters go to the polls, we look at who's financing presidential candidates and what contributors expect in return. We'll talk with Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity and author of the new book, The Buying of the President 2004. He says despite campaign finance reform, candidates are still raising tens of millions of dollars, and interest groups are funneling huge contributions their way. Also, we meet mountain climber Joe Simpson. The new film, Touching the Void, is the story of his ill-fated climb on the Sierra Grande in Peru. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography, Elizabeth and Mary, Cousins, Rivals, Queens, by Jane Dunn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As voters go to the polls in New Hampshire, the Democratic candidates haven't stopped looking for votes to win the primary. They're also hoping to get some momentum for the group of contests coming next week. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The weather is practically balmy in New Hampshire today, all the way up into the 20s, a relief from the zero temperatures over the weekend, and that may increase turnout, which could break the previous record of 184,000 votes cast in 1992. The race here has generated tremendous interest and enthusiasm, and the candidates have all been speaking to overflow crowds around the state. New Hampshire has 22 delegates, not a big number, but a win here can give candidates valuable momentum as they head to states like South Carolina, Arizona, Missouri, and New Mexico, which all hold primaries or caucuses on February 3rd. Because there are so many states voting at once on that day, the candidates will be competing with television ads instead of one-on-one at pancake breakfasts and chili feeds, the way they've campaigned in New Hampshire this week. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Manchester.
Analyst Andrew Kohut has been looking at surveys of people as they left the polling places after voting in today's primary. He says voters say the most important issues influencing their votes were health care and the war in Iraq, but many were also concerned with the candidate's ability to beat President Bush.
49% described themselves as angry with President Bush. Another 35% said they were dissatisfied, but not angry. And electability is one of the important qualities that voters are looking for. The candidate best able to beat Bush was selected as the top personal quality by 21%. Only the candidate who stands closest to my issues topped that as a quality that New Hampshire voters were looking for.
Andrew Kohut is the director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. A plane filled with components from Libya's nuclear weapons program has landed in Tennessee. The White House says the shipment shows Libya is serious about its promise to end its pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said the plane landed this morning. It contained 55,000 pounds of documents and what he called critical equipment. That includes uranium, centrifuge parts, and missile guidance systems. David Albright, an analyst with the Institute for Science and International Security, says the equipment is a gold mine. The U.S. will want to study the components, see how well they were put together, and where they came from. The U.S. intelligence community will want to learn how it was that the program escaped notice. Mostly, he says the idea is to dismantle Libya's nuclear program and get the components out of the country in case officials there change their minds. Tennessee is home to Oak Ridge National Laboratory. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 92 points to close at 10,609. The NASDAQ was down 37 points to close at 2,116. This is NPR News. The winter storm making its way through the east has left more than 300,000 people without power in the Carolinas and northeast Georgia. About a dozen people in the Carolinas have died, mostly in traffic accidents. Lita Hartman reports from Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Most of the people who lost power are in South Carolina, where the storm did its worst damage, laying up to 3/4 of an inch of ice on trees and power lines. But conditions in the eastern part of North Carolina are also treacherous. Parts of Interstate 95 are down to one lane on each side, and the city of Wilson has set up a shelter for stranded motorists. Airports in Charlotte, Greensboro, Raleigh-Durham, and Greenville are open, but many flights have been delayed. Many schools and businesses in both states remain closed, and no real relief in the form of warmer temperatures can be expected till at least tomorrow. A mix of light sleet and freezing rain is forecast to continue across eastern North Carolina and upstate South Carolina today, and more snow is expected in the Appalachians. For NPR News, I'm Lita Hartman in Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Federal regulators are proposing a $750,000 fine against Clear Channel Communications for broadcasting a sexually explicit radio program. The Federal Communications Commission said it fined each of four Clear Channel stations the maximum $27,500 for each time they aired an episode of the program called Bubba the Love Sponge. All four stations were in Florida. Clear Channel has 30 days to appeal or pay the fine. Clear Channel President Mark Mays said today that the media should come together to establish what he called clear standards for indecency. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of radios, games, and gadgets selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Primary voters in New Hampshire hit the polls today as America dives into its first presidential race since the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002. But our guest Charles Lewis says the new law hasn't made the world safe for democracy. Lewis heads the Center for Public Integrity, a D.C.-based nonprofit that doggedly tracks political contributions and assembles reports on special interests at work in Washington. Lewis and the Center have published a new book, The Buying of the President 2004, which concludes big money is still finding its way into politicians' campaign chests. The book is in part a reference guide, including lists of the top 10 contributors to every presidential candidate. Charles Lewis spent 11 years as a producer for ABC and CBS News before leaving to found the Center for Public Integrity in 1989. I spoke to him last week. He said presidential candidates now have to raise a lot of money the year before the election to be seen as serious contenders in early media coverage.
It ends up being very detrimental to the other candidates who maybe can't raise that much. So if one's raising $30 or $40 million and the other is raising $3 million, then the storyline, you know, months and months before Iowa and New Hampshire is that someone is a loser and can't find any support. And you frequently see candidates drop out months before the actual primary season starts for that very reason. And a lot of people are very frustrated by this. They call it the wealth primary or private referendum, where the people that actually select some of our choices at the front end are sort of faceless, nameless. I mean, you can find them in the records somewhere, but they are writing checks. And the people who write checks and max out the $2,000 contributions and things like that, 90% of that money goes in the year before the election. So it is a lot of the election, a big part of it, occurred already last year.
You said a private referendum, in effect, of contributors that occurs before the rest of us get involved.
That's right.
Let's go over some of the Democrats that are still in the race and tell us a little bit about where they get their money and where they are on issues of campaign integrity and accountability. Howard Dean, now, you might look at his internet-based fundraising campaign and think it's exactly the kind of broad-based Democratic effort we'd like to see in campaigns, is it?
Well, his numbers are very low. As a Vermont governor, and they have limits up in Vermont, unlike Texas, a lot of Bush's numbers are high because he was from a state with no limits. So Enron is his top donor from when he was in Texas. Dean's top donor is 65,000, approximately one-tenth of the Enron numbers, partly because of the function of Vermont. Certainly, the internet phenomenon with Dean is very, very interesting. It will be studied for years. It has revolutionized fundraising. Candidates in 2000 used the internet, but not anywhere near as effectively as Dean did. Being able to raise $800,000 to $1 million in a single day is really quite, amazing and unprecedented. Now a lot of donors outside Vermont have begun to flock to Dean. In the fall, it appeared he was in the summer and the fall, he started to look like the possible nominee. So you have Time Warner, Microsoft, IBM are his top three contributors. But the amounts of money are pretty low, and they're executives inside those companies, presumably. $65,000, the top donor. The other second one is $25,000. And so the amounts of money he has raised are not very large in the general context of candidates at that level as a major presidential candidate. He does have a closeness to companies in Vermont. For example, the utility industry has given him thousands of dollars. His former chief of staff went to become the chief lobbyist for the largest utility in Vermont, and there are some ratepayers who are still fighting mad about favors they perceived were given to the utility companies up there. So he is actually acknowledged that special interests have access that's uneven and unfair compared with other citizens, and that a candidate can be influenced. He's been open about that. He hasn't been that open about his records, which we also talk about in the book.
John Kerry is a longstanding advocate of campaign finance reform. He's refused to take political action committee money in the past. Does he put his fundraising conduct where his mouth is?
Well, no, the short answer. He's gotten in some brushes, scrapes himself with scandal. Remember Johnny Chung, the funder who mysteriously gave money to Clinton and went to prison, and there was another fellow named Paul from Florida. These were associates or donors to Kerry, and he had to give their money back over the years. But he has raised large sums of money. His top donor is Mintz Levin, a law firm in Boston that his brother is a partner at. They represent Atlanta Telecom interests, and Kerry is on the Commerce Committee in the Senate. He has assisted some of these wireless and other high-tech telecom-type companies try to get favors from the Federal Communication Commission. So he has gone to bat for his donors. Now, some of those companies are probably in Massachusetts, and he would argue, you know, that he was helping his constituents. But there is a pattern of assisting donors and doing things for them and having a— He's on amazing committees. He's on the Finance Committee and the Commerce Committee, which means those two committees have jurisdiction over every industry in America. If you're a donor and the guy's a three-term senator, you need him. He needs you. He needs money. They need access and influence over their agendas. And he takes a lot of their money, and he has been helpful to many of these companies over time. It's not a dollar-to-dollar relationship with any of these politicians, but occasionally they get what they are seeking, and they certainly have substantial access.
What should we know about John Edwards?
Edwards, the two things that are noteworthy. One is probably well known. Yes, as a trial lawyer, a very successful trial lawyer, he is very close to the trial lawyers, and so 22 of his 25 contributors are trial lawyers or, you know, law firms or lawyers. But the other thing is, he actually is a freshman senator and only in politics for less than 6 years. He has the biggest single contributor in the entire book, which is a real, you know, man bites dog fact, at least to me. Shangri-La Entertainment, Stephen Bing in Hollywood, who's a big Democratic Party donor, has given him $907,000. Most of his other donors are $400,000 or under. But that's somewhat interesting. That shows sort of the Hollywood thing that sometimes happens, particularly with Democrats, where they get excited about a candidate or two. We need to know a lot more about Mr. Bing, which, you know, I'd like to know more. But that's what we noticed right off. And then we have lots of things in the book about his cases and how he rose to fame and his background personally. But that's the story with his money.
Wesley Clark, the retired general, hasn't spent a lot of time raising money. He did do some lobbying. What should we know about him?
Well, yeah, he is. A lot of the Clinton fundraising network has embraced Clark. We added the Clark chapter after we finished the manuscript. He entered the race, you'll recall, back in the fall, and so we added the chapter. And a retired general doesn't have a long record of contributions in his career, but he's now raised about $13 million in about 3 months, which is pretty impressive for any candidate, and especially for a Democratic candidate. And so they're from all the sort of usual suspects, a lot of big business interests and union interests and others. And we're still waiting to see some of the numbers on that because the fourth quarter hasn't come out. The most interesting thing is the lobbying relationship. He was a registered lobbyist at the time he announced his candidacy, September 17th. He was trying to help this company called Axiom get government contracts, including airport security and other contracts, including defense. And it's not unusual for a retired general to help contractors get contracts. That happens, unfortunately, way too often. But it is interesting because he was an analyst for CNN talking about the war during Iraq and talking about airport security in the U.S. and other homeland security issues while he had privately had been reportedly lobbying the vice president personally and other top officials inside the Bush administration and doing everything he can to help this company. He is publicly being a quote-unquote neutral analyst, and the viewers were never informed of that. And it just shows how complex Clark is. He's setting up a committee to run for president. He's a retired general helping a contractor, and he's on TV as a commentator, all simultaneously, all the same person. And the public didn't know about one of those three things.
My guest is Charles Lewis, director of the Center for Public Integrity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity in Washington. His new book is The Buying of the President, 2004. Charles Lewis, you've written that George W. Bush has redefined the parameters of fundraising. What did you mean?
Well, no one has ever seen numbers like this. He raised $125 million in the 2000 election, including nearly $70 million the year before the election. Or put differently, $230,000 a day in 1999 compared to Al Gore's $84,000 a day. So he, you know, those were astonishing numbers in 99. He has now raised $130 million this time, the year before the election. He has $99 million cash on hand with no primary opponent. This is just radically transforming American politics. Numbers have never, ever been remotely seen. The champion fundraiser of all time, we thought, was Bill Clinton. And this guy nearly tripled the numbers of the Democratic candidate back then. And so when you look at it that way, that's one reason we've never seen anything like it. The other thing, and the way he has done it, is the pioneer system. He has found a way to bundle contributions in a highly sophisticated way where he can find an amazing number of people willing to write checks at the maximum amount. The maximum contribution today is $2,000. Back in 2000, it was $1,000. It's been increased with the McCain-Feingold legislation. But
now you've noted, I think, that they have a sophisticated system of coding each contribution internally so that they can track who gets credit for it. What's the significance of that in this bundling process?
Well, the significance is, and this there's a lot of deposition and question and answer testimony that's really quite interesting from the McCain-Feingold Supreme Court case where they admit this stuff. They say, well, yeah, the industry has to get credit. And you've got to think, why do they want credit? Well, they want credit because they're going to be back asking for something. That's why they want credit. And why else would you care? I mean, the pioneer person, the person who raises $100,000 is called a pioneer. The person now, this election, who raises $200,000 is called a ranger. And they do want to get credit that it goes to them personally, so they get to be called a pioneer or a ranger. So that's, you could argue, that's the only reason they do it. But there is actually comment from a utility executive who went to college with George W. Bush, who is a pioneer, who said, we want our industry to get credit. And he actually put it out in a letter to his other industry fellow executives. Now, and you know, the utility industry has gotten certain favors from the administration, and so you've got to think they knew that they would have close access to power. There was also personal familiarity, and they were giving astonishing sums of money bundled together, and that's sort of how it worked. We write in the book that this election, because of Bush's fundraising prowess, has the chance to be the most lopsided financially since the Nixon-McGovern race back in 72. I mean, the Republicans, because of Bush's prowess raising money, they're still a kind of a difficult situation here in terms of accountability and openness in our political process, to put it mildly. And one party in this instance, the Democrats, is frankly terrified that they are completely outgunned and they're scrambling to try to recover.
What do you think George W. Bush's particular fundraising genius is? How do you account for his enormous success?
I think his genius is that he has found a way to organize a donor base nationwide to an uncanny and extraordinary extent, where industries are clamoring to outgive each other, and they all get credit for the giving, and it's all understood, and it is shameless and unabashed bundling of contributions, which goes against the spirit of the post-Watergate laws. It is highly organized bundling. And, you know, you have to give them credit. It's brilliant. I mean, it's ingenious. And it's entirely legal, I should emphasize. There's nothing illegal about this. It's just disconcerting that so many people are giving all these contributions from industries, getting credit for the contributions and boasting that their industry has given them the most. And then we notice later they're getting various dispensations in Washington. And you can't directly say A calls B, but don't tell me 2 plus 2 equals 7, because it's pretty obvious to us what's going on.
Now, you you recount what happened in 2000 when John McCain got off to a very good start when he was challenging George W. Bush for the nomination. And then came the South Carolina primary, which you write epitomizes the profoundly disturbing state of American politics today. What happened in that primary that tells us that story?
Well, what was profoundly disturbing to me was that facts don't matter. As an investigative reporter, facts to me are very, very important. And not only did McCain get mugged, figuratively speaking, in South Carolina, he had won New Hampshire. He's on the cover of all the magazines. And 19 days later, he's a failed candidate. His national campaign's dead in the water. What happened? Well, what happened is Bush outspent him 5-1, and outside groups came in and dumped millions of dollars as well. So you had more than $20 million probably spent in South Carolina to McCain's $3 million. But you had a lot of mysterious groups from the Confederate flag to, you know, normal groups that are frequently associated with the Republicans, such as, you know, anti-abortion and those kinds of organizations, all lining up around without officially saying they're part of the Bush apparatus, sending out phone banks, emails, leaflet drops, radio ads in the 11th hour that are very hard to detect who paid for them. Bush never said he had no idea why this was happening. He was he took the high road in the latter days of his campaign. And when it was all said and done, not only is McCain's candidacy stopped cold, but the exit polling shows that voters thought the reformer was actually Bush. Bush had run ads calling himself the reformer with results. When you study his record in Texas, he never reformed politics. He, in fact, was an opponent of campaign finance reform. And so by running an ad repeatedly almost into the ground and in every appearance having a sign behind his head that said reformer with results, the public began to think that he was really a reformer.
Anybody interested in campaign finance reform would have to say that this, you know, 2002 was a huge year, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and it was upheld by the Supreme Court. How much of a difference will it make? How far will it go in reforming the way we elect our public officials?
It's not a panacea. It is an incremental beginning. Yes, soft money has been ended officially, and there are some limitations on these issue ads as they run in campaigns. But presidential candidates still have to go out and raise $100 to $200 million from private sources. Conventions, we give a check for $12 million, but they go raise 3 or 4 times that much from special interests. Three candidates, Kerry, Dean, and Bush, have opted out of the presidential matching fund system, which would seem to suggest that system is broken. If it's going to continue, it's got to be seriously changed, I think, by all accounts. Yes, the McCain-Feingold thing was huge because it was the first major piece of legislation since Watergate, since 1974 in the U.S. And, you know, it took, as we all know, it took McCain almost a decade to get the thing passed. You know, you know how everyone understands how hard they worked to try to even get it on the agenda. For 3 full years, the Republican Congress in the mid-90s would not even put the legislation on the agenda. That's how hard it was to get this thing to climb the hill on this. And the president signed it holding his nose, proverbially. He went off to a fundraiser after he signed it. He didn't have a public statement for TV or radio about it. He quietly issued a little statement and left town. And then, of course, authorized his party to try to overturn it in the Supreme Court behind the scenes. So this has been a very tough road, and you know these reformers are fighting mad, and they feel emboldened. I mean, they're actually feel they've been validated by the Supreme Court, and they're getting ready to come back with a whole laundry list of changes in American politics. And the other side that lost is astonished, taken aback, licking their wounds, and getting ready to continue the fight in other trenches.
A lot of what you do at the Center for Public Integrity is to develop information and shine a light on that exposes relationships that otherwise wouldn't be known. And as somebody who's done political reporting, I've written a lot of stories over the years about political contributors who've gotten government contracts or favors favors, and apparently in return for contributions. And I've found that they don't have a great effect. I mean, I find that I've had politicians tell me, yeah, I know if I take a contribution from this company or something, I'll take a media hit, but frankly, it's worth it because in the end, it doesn't matter that much. I'm wondering if you kind of feel the frustration as someone who constantly cries out about the truth but gets ignored.
Well, I'm not in therapy yet, but yes, it does bother me. It is frustrating. I mean, let's be honest. It doesn't matter to the politicians because half the electorate doesn't participate in democracy anymore. 100 million Americans do not vote. A lot of the folks that don't vote are poor and disenfranchised from the system economically already, and they've just essentially given up. They think that they don't matter. They can't get through to politicians. So the politician desperately needs the money, and who do you think they're going to listen to, the person that doesn't vote or the voting bloc that doesn't vote or the folks who are paying their bills for their consultants and their polling and their ads? And so it's very clear to see what has happened to our process. It's becoming, you know, not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but some people and folks who have checkbooks. And, you know, at some point as a people, we have to – the public has to speak and try to get their government back, whether it's at the local level or the national level. The question is, will they mobilize? Will that start to happen? And you see glimmers of hope occasionally where there's a pulse. There's a media ownership vote, and nearly 3 million people contact the Federal Communication Commission as recent as last June. That's unusual. That's interesting. That's not typical. Most of the things that happen in Washington are behind closed doors. The hearings are mostly peopled by lobbyists paid to be there. And the process is sponsored by these elite interests. A $1,000 or $2,000 check comes from 0.1% of the American people. That is who is substantially sponsoring our politicians today. And it is frustrating to continually chronicle it. And this is the third Buying of the President book. But, you know, we are going to continue to go into the brick wall here and keep tracking it just because I guess we're masochists.
Charles Lewis, thanks much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Charles Lewis, director of the Center for Public Integrity. His new book is The Buying of the President 2004. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, mountain climber and author Joe Simpson. In one harrowing climb in the Peruvian Andes, his knee was shattered and he was left for dead by his climbing partner. Simpson survived, and his book, Touching the Void, is now a feature film. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book about the rivalry between Queen Elizabeth I and her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, mountain climber and writer Joe Simpson, faced death several times on one harrowing journey in the Peruvian Andes in 1985. His 1988 book, Touching the Void, has now been made into a movie, which combines interviews with Simpson and his climbing partner, Simon Yates, with reenactments of climbing scenes done by actors. Here's the real Joe Simpson speaking in the film, describing the treacherous landscape.
It was this Andean nightmare of flutings of the finest powder gorged out by snow falling down, meringues and mushrooms and cornices all over the place. We'd heard about these strange powder snow conditions you get in the Andes, and we'd never seen them before. I don't know the physics that explains why powder snow can stay on such steep slopes. In the Alps, it would just slide off if the slope was above 40 degrees. It is some of the most precarious, unnerving, and dangerous climbing I've ever done.
Touching the Void tells the story of Simpson and Yates' climb up the west face of the Sierra Grande, a 21,000-foot Andean peak never previously summited. They reached the summit in 2.5 days, but disaster struck during their descent.
When we were coming down, we came down the North Ridge, and we spent half a night coming down, then we bivouacked high on the ridge. And the next day, we started to come down again, and I was trying to down-climb a vertical ice cliff that was about 30 feet high, and some ice broke away, and my axe ripped out, and I fell about 20 foot max, more likely 15 foot, but I landed, my right leg hit first, and the impact drove my lower leg straight through my knee joint. My tibia went through my knee joint and split off. I also broke my heel and my ankle, but I didn't really notice that at the time. We were at 20,000 feet. This was all our nightmare scenarios come true, because we knew there was no other people in that area in the Andes. There was no mountain rescue, there was no helicopter. And usually to get a man this badly injured off a mountain, you'd have a 10-man rescue team, and Simon was just there on his own. And to my amazement, I thought he was going to have to leave me, and I wouldn't have blamed him if he had done, but he attempted to lower me down the mountain and at great risk to his own life, and lowered me for 3,000 feet before second disaster struck.
Tell us about the moment when your eyes first met Simon's and you explained to him what happened, and you both immediately realized the seriousness of the situation.
Well, when I impacted, I didn't actually feel it. I heard this sound like a sick, dry stick snapping, and but then I just catapulted backwards, and I started falling down the east face, and I thought Simon was going to get pulled with me, but after about 50 feet, I stopped, and the pain was absolutely excruciating, and for a moment I couldn't believe I had broken my leg, because I remember seeing a mountain in the distance that we were level with the summit of, and I knew that we were still at 20,000 feet, and the implications of a fracture were like a death sentence. And I remember actually putting my hand inside my trousers to feel if there was a bone end sticking out, and there wasn't, so I thought that maybe I was just being a bit wet, so I tried to stand on it, and all the bones went again. I knew it was broken, and then suddenly the rope went snack, and it meant that Simon was coming towards me. And I was pretty much panicking at that point, because I thought, well, he's going to have to leave me. And he suddenly appeared at the top of the cliff, and he was looking at me and said, are you okay? And I said, no, I've broken my leg. And he just looked at me longer, longer than he should have done, really. He didn't say anything at all. And the sort of look he gave me was a sort of, it was strange, really. It was like looking at a wounded animal or something. And then he turned away, because he had to try and sort out how he was going to get down this cliff to me. And I was very scared about that, because he was silent. And I sort of realized now that, we don't have, we're never taught any protocol, by which you tell your friend that you're going to leave him to die. And he didn't know what to do, so he resorted to silence. In the meantime, I tried to climb sideways across this ice slope. There's about a 3,000-foot drop underneath me. And I was sort of thinking, well, it might show willing to Simon that I wasn't dead in the water. But I also thought, well, he's got to leave me, so I might as well try and get on with it. About an hour later, or 45 minutes later, he suddenly appeared by my side. And he didn't actually say anything. And I thought, well, this is the point that he has to leave me. and I couldn't really make eye contact with him. I knew what the score was, and he climbed below me and then up the other side. And after a while, expecting to see him gone, I looked to my right, and he was digging a small sort of foot trench in the ice and the snow, helping me to climb sideways towards him. And from that point on, I realised that, for reasons best known to himself, he was going to try and stay with me and help me.
So he improvises this fairly heroic attempt to get you down the mountain, at which you tie two 150-foot lengths of rope together, and you dig out a snow seat for him to brace himself, and he lowers you down 300 feet at a time.
Well, Simon lowered me from sort of 11 o'clock in the morning until like 9 o'clock at night in just the most phenomenal single-handed rescue that I've ever heard about. And suffering frostbite. We were both suffering frostbite in our fingers and our hands. And we were in the dark, in a storm, almost nil communication, no visibility after about 30 feet. And unbeknownst to us, he was lowering me towards an overhanging cliff of ice that was directly in our path, and he lowered me off the edge of it. And the sudden, complete body weight coming onto the rope very nearly pulled him off, and he had to let the rope go and then slowly, dynamically break the rope, by which time I was hanging out in space. I couldn't even contact the wall of the ice cliff, and to my horror, discovered that I was a long, long way above the base of this cliff, at which lay a covered up, but quite obviously a crevasse. Simon, desperate to get my weight off the rope, lowered me, hoping that, you know, after a few feet I'd put my feet on the ground. But after a while, when I was still hanging 80 feet above the crevasse, I came to a stop, and I knew that the knot joining the two ropes had come up and jammed in his lowering device, and we were locked into the system, and there was nothing he could do about it. And from then on, basically my body weight was pulling him off. He hung on to me for about an hour and a half. I could feel him sort of gradually inching down the mountain, and I was sort of jerking down. It was like being on a fishing line, and I just knew that he eventually would just get ripped off the mountain.
And you expected to die at that point?
Yes, I was in shock. I was in great pain. I was probably close to hypothermic, and I'd had about enough, really. I felt basically a sort of a twinge of anger that my friend was going to have to die as well. And it all, because we'd made a pretty strong attempt to save ourselves, and it seemed so unfair that it should all go wrong. Literally, probably one lower from the bottom of the mountain. And then suddenly I found myself free-falling backwards. Fell 80 feet, hit the roof of this crevasse, which is very thick. It almost stopped me. And then I broke through on my right shoulder and fell headfirst into this crevasse, into the darkness. Fell about another 75, 80 feet, and then powered into a snow bridge that was crossing the width of the crevasse and stopped.
Simon, you were fell because Simon had cut the rope.
I didn't know that. I thought Simon had fallen off. I had no idea. I thought he'd just come off, and that's what I was expecting, that he would suddenly, you know, come wanging off. And in fact, when I came to in the crevasse and made myself safe, and I looked at this rope that was going up and out through the ceiling of the crevasse, 80 feet above me, I thought, well, that's going to... Simon's body's flown over the crevasse and is dead down slope, and if I pull on the rope, it will come tight in his body, and I can use that as a counterweight, and using special knots, I can climb up the rope. And so I kept pulling on the rope, and then suddenly... there was this sort of, and this frayed rope came down, and it meant two things. It meant that Simon was alive, and he had my knife.
At that moment, were you angry that he'd cut the rope? Did you understand?
No, not at all. I was never angry. I mean, my friend was alive. You know, it was important. But more important, from an entirely selfish point of view, was that... you know, while he was alive, he could help me. I was now trapped in a deep crevasse that it was impossible to climb out of vertically from where I was. And, you know, Simon being dead was of absolutely no use to me and not much use to himself. And I then had a nightmarish night, not sure whether Simon was climbing down. Actually, he'd taken shelter quite wisely. I was then forced to make perhaps the most frightening decision I've ever made in my life, which was... you know, you don't die of a broken leg. You die slowly of dehydration and hypothermia, and it would take 3 or 4 days in a twilight world. I mean, crevasses are very claustrophobic, nightmarish places to be, and they have the feel of the tomb about them. And I wasn't prepared to do that, but my only option was to lower myself with my half of the rope deeper into the crevasse, which was completely counterintuitive to everything that my mind wanted to do. It was a very, very frightening decision, but... I did eventually do it, and I lowered myself another 80 feet deeper into this crevasse, and to my great good fortune found a way by crawling towards the north. I found a slope running up about 160 feet and managed to eventually climb out of the crevasse.
So you did you're climbing out with your right leg utterly useless, using, I guess, what, ice axes, and pulling yourself up and crawling. And
yeah, it's quite a steep slope. I mean, you're having to hop upwards, and the trouble is if you fracture your knee, you can't bend your knee to get your lower leg out of the way. So when you hop out, you almost inevitably land on your bad foot, which puts pressure on the broken joint because your knee doesn't bend anymore. You know, the leg has gone through the knee joint, and so it was excruciatingly painful trying to climb up. And when I did get out, I mean, initially I was just laughing because I was so relieved to get out of this place, this sort of claustrophobic, nightmarish place where I was going to die. And then I looked around, and way off to my left, I saw a rope hanging down a rock and ice buttress, which Simon had obviously used to abseil down. And when I looked to the glacier, I saw his tracks in the snow. And I knew at that point that, you know, he would never have left if he thought I was alive, and that the only person who could possibly help me in this world that I was in now thought I was dead. And that was a pretty chilling moment.
But you took, what, 3 days? And
well, from then, another 3.5, best part of 4 days, really, without food and water. I eventually, on the morning of the fifth day since breaking my leg, and virtually 4 days since parting company with Simon, I got to within 200 yards of where the tents were, in the dark, in a storm, completely disorientated. And by then, very delirious and not really knowing where I was. I mean, by then I weighed about somewhere between 80 and 85 pounds, and I was probably dying at that point, and I was delirious. And I think I screamed out, not because I thought they were there, but just in desperation and fear. And suddenly these lights came on in a tent about 200 yards away, and they were still there. They were leaving 3 hours later at 6 a.m, and suddenly Simon came sort of charging out of this tent and found me.
I want to just go back to one moment. When you had to make this overland trek, the 8 miles back down to the base camp, you had a bum leg.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah, a shattered leg. You crawl, you hop. How did it work?
Well, you can't really crawl because you're crawling over boulders and huge sort of rocks, and often they're all jumbled on top of each other. So you're doing everything from hopping, using your ice axe as a walking stick, and trying to clamber over things. And you're falling virtually every time you try and hop. You're constantly falling, and you're falling on the broken knee. And I can't remember the pain, but I know it was just almost unendurable. I mean, I don't even remember the fear either, because that's difficult to recall. But I recall a long, drawn-out sense of abandonment, a loneliness that it's very difficult to put your finger on. I think what I now realize it was is dying. I was dying alone, and that's the memory I'm left with. And the one thing I think I kept doing was I was crawling not because I wanted to live, but because I wanted somebody to hold me when I died. And I still can recall that moment when Simon's hands grabbed my shoulders and he pulled me towards him and carried me to the tent. I mean, it was just the most extraordinary reprieve from, you know, it was as if I was walking to the gallows and somebody had just tapped me on the shoulder and said, "It's okay, Joe, everything's okay now, you're going to be safe."
My guest is mountain climber and author Joe Simpson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with mountain climber and author Joe Simpson. His book, Touching the Void, is now a feature film. Well, Joe Simpson, you write in this book that you were a different kind of climber back in, I guess you were 25 when you first made this disastrous attempt. Well, it was a successful climb, but a disastrous trip. You wrote of having a sense of invincibility, the confidence born of youth, too much testosterone, and too little imagination. Were you and Simon
ill-prepared?
Were you and Simon ill-prepared for this thing?
No, not at all, no. I mean, there's no way we would have managed to climb that route if we were bad climbers. We made mistakes. Every friend of mine who's died in the mountains, and there's some 15 or 20 of them, made a mistake, and that's what killed them. The best climbers in the world that are dead made a mistake. That's just the game you're playing.
Well, were these mistakes of immaturity? I mean, looking back now,
no,
would you
not
do
really.
It
I mean, I think that, you know, we'd done a huge amount of climbing, of extreme climbing in the European Alps in both the winter and the summer. We'd done some of the hardest routes in the Alps. We were technically very, very competent climbers. This was our first trip to high altitude, and so we were moving into a new plane and a new area. I would still have climbed the route in the same style. We did it in 2.5 days, and when the route was repeated, you know, 16 years later, the people who repeated it took the same time as us, despite the advance of 16 years of development of ice climbing gear. So we were good climbers. We would never have got up the face if we weren't good climbers. And to be truthful, we would never have survived what we did if we didn't know what we were doing. But without a doubt, we made mistakes. We didn't take enough food with us. We didn't take enough gas with us because we were trying to go as light and as fast as possible. And it meant that when something did go wrong, we didn't have any sort of backup in so much as we couldn't take shelter and take back control because we'd run out of gas and we couldn't make any water and we'd run out of food. And I suppose, just like any experience, and that this is what you do as climbers, you know, we got home, we looked at what we did wrong and thought, well, what did we do wrong? And then we went climbing again, having learnt very strong lessons. And that tends to be what you do in climbing.
You know, one of the striking things about the ordeal you went through is that there were so many times in which it seemed clear that you were a goner. I mean, not many people come so near death. Did it change you at all? Did it change the way you look at climbing? Did it change the way you look at your life?
I never quite climbed the same again. I actually climbed at much higher technical standards on rock and ice, but, you know, a lot of high-end climbing is actually mental, and I never quite did such a committing route again, which I think was a shame. That was something stolen from me, but I didn't.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that? You said you never did such a committing route again. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I went to the Himalayas and Peru, and I did alpine-style first ascents of new routes, but they were never as technically difficult and serious as the one we did on Sea Le Grand, which is really what I wanted to do, you know. So that was not because of the technical difficulty. That was because of the mental scars that I carry with me from that experience in Peru. But, I mean, I don't regret that. I have climbed all over the world. But I think, you know, people sort of wonder what it must be like to experience something like this, and it, you don't feel when you survive something like this, like, you know, you're sort of gung ho or heroic or you've done anything, you know, particularly special, because the process of surviving this, or in my case, a long drawn out dying, was very, very destructive, both physically and mentally, and perhaps mentally worst of all. You know, I never expected to be so slowly destroyed, so that everything that you thought you were, everything that you thought made you strong as a man or good as a person, was just whittled away until you were just a crying, feeble, childlike figure, and you'd even seem to have lost your whole personality. And right at the end, I was given my life back because Simon found me, and I just always felt, and have always felt, very humbled by the experience, that it was... It made me feel very fragile and very weak, even though I may have at times shown a great deal of strength and determination. It's never struck me as like that. It struck me that I was very lucky, and I just sort of live every day now and plan on things I want to do in the future. This did happen 18 years ago. Although the book's been very successful and now the film, it sort of locks you in the past and makes you always sort of seem to be living 1985 and touching the void all over again. But I don't do that. I think of the next book I want to write, the things I want to do with my gardening, the fly fishing trip I've got in Scotland next week. Not in Scotland, in Ireland. And I don't think about what happened in Peru. It's not worth dwelling on the past and beating yourself up. Just get on with life.
Well, Joe Simpson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Author and mountain climber Joe Simpson. His book, Touching the Void, is now a feature film. Coming up, a new look at the highly charged relationship between Queen Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots. This is Fresh Air. Some four centuries after their reigns, Queen Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, seem more like icons than actual flesh-and-blood women. Elizabeth is the stern virgin queen. Mary, her beautiful cousin, is a romantic who died a Catholic martyr. Last year in England, a book came out that explored not so much the lives of these two queens, but the life of their highly charged and very human relationship. Called Elizabeth and Mary, it's written by celebrated biographer Jane Dunn, who's written previous biographies of Mary Shelley and Virginia Woolf. Elizabeth and Mary has just been published here, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The age-old question of how a woman in politics is supposed to behave came to the fore last week when Dr. Judy Steinberg Dean was criticized for behaving as though she still had a right to an autonomous private life, while her husband, Howard Dean, was busy campaigning for the Democratic nomination for president. Dutifully, Dr. Steinberg Dean responded by materializing at her husband's side, smiling and clapping with the good wifely gusto of a Hillary or a Laura. I was disappointed at Dr. Steinberg Dean's capitulation. I complained to a friend, "The government should just appoint Harvey Fierstein to be permanent first lady. He did such a good job female impersonating Mrs. Santa Claus in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, and he could really carry off those little red suits and that helmet hairdo and the adoring gaze first ladies are supposed to wear." I thought I was being so clever. Then I read Jane Dunn's fascinating biography, Elizabeth and Mary, about the vexed rivalry between Queen Elizabeth I and her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots. It turns out Queen Elizabeth was way ahead of me in hitting upon the mixed messages of androgyny as a strategy to navigate her way through the overwhelmingly masculine world of Renaissance politics. In response to vicious critics like John Knox and John Calvin, who pronounced female rulers monstriferous and her reign a deviation from the primitive and established order of nature, Dunn says Elizabeth declared that she was possessed of a mystical sexual duality. Though she had the natural body of a woman, frail, flighty, and flirtatious, she also possessed the maleness inherent in her body politic, the heart of a lion and the mind of a scholar. In contrast, poor Mary, Queen of Scots, who ruled in a strictly feminine manner by relying on her sexuality and her husband's and male admirers to achieve her political ambitions, wound up literally losing her pretty little head. Both queens explicitly reflected in letters and other documents on their conundrum as women in power, a subject that makes Dunn's elegantly intertwined biography of their relationship feel so contemporary. At the same time, Dunn also invokes a substantive vision of a superstitious and bloody Renaissance world that's impossibly weird and distant, a world where torture on the rack or assassination by poisoning were everyday political realities. The gist of her scrupulously detailed argument is that Elizabeth and Mary, who never once met in person, were hyper-aware of each other from childhood, and that in part they fashioned themselves as rulers and as women in reaction to each other. Mary, who was Elizabeth's junior by 9 years, was brought up in the glittering Catholic French court, where she was encouraged to believe that she was the legitimate heir to the English throne, rather than Elizabeth, the daughter of that Protestant Jezebel, Anne Boleyn. Mary married 3 times, each succeeding husband more virile and dastardly than his predecessor. Elizabeth's early and dogged allegiance to celibacy, despite her passion for the Earl of Leicester, allowed her to maintain her independence while strategically dangling her hand in marriage for decades to eligible foreign monarchs. Yet, as Dunn points out, Elizabeth's canny political choice was surely also motivated by the spectacle of grotesque marriages, her mother's and father's chief among them, she witnessed from childhood. Marriage, family, and political entanglements noted, Dunn says that the turbulent relationship between the two queens was the most important connection of both their lives. Even towards the end of their joint story, as Elizabeth held Mary her prisoner for 19 years on suspicion of treason, a charge that would result in her beheading, Elizabeth attested to the emotional thrall her cousin held her in, declaring, "I am not free, but a captive." Dunn's astute psychological reading of the relationship between the two queens never oversteps into the realm of glibness or sensationalism. And after all, there's plenty of R-rated material inherent in even a bare-bones account of Mary and Elizabeth's reigns. There's also a fair amount of humor here, an element that humanizes Elizabeth in particular. Dunn tells the story of the Earl of Oxford, who returned to Elizabeth's court after 7 years of self-imposed exile, after having embarrassed himself in front of the Queen. The mischievous Elizabeth greeted him with the words, "My lord, I had forgot the fart." It's hard to imagine a woman in the political spotlight these days saying anything in public remotely so ribald. Harvey Fierstein, maybe. The First Ladies Club, never.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Elizabeth and Mary by Jane Dunn. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Shooting the Sun by Max Bird, a novel of the expedition in 1839 to photograph the solar eclipse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, baseball's all-time hit leader, Pete Rose. Banned from the game since 1989 for his gambling habit, Rose finally admits he bet on baseball in a new book. He'll tell us how he played the game, how he coped with prison, and why some in baseball aren't buying his apology. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.